Passover is much more than the story, as almost every biblical story is more than the story. As I'm very fond of talking about, and this is a very important concept when looking at any biblical material, is it's not about facts, it's about truth. It's not about what happened, because very few scholars believe that 600,000 Hebrews spent 40 years wandering in the Sinai, because even stubborn men who wouldn't ask for directions could get across the Sinai faster than 40 years, and they would leave M&M wrappers and Slurpee cups, and there's no archaeological evidence of that actually having happened, but that's no more important than the lesson about whether George Washington cut down a cherry tree or not. The lesson is in the story. The truths are in the story. The facts may differ. Passover is often just called the birthday of freedom for the Hebrew people. It's filled with stories that are used and reused by all religions. The whole story of Passover, of going from darkness and slavery in a journey towards light and a promised land, is a metaphor on so many different levels. It becomes the salvation story for Judaism. Salvation in Judaism is physical. It is bread today. When my mother-in-law talks about somebody having saved her, that's the Jewish sense of salvation. It is being saved today. When she talked about somebody who saved her at Auschwitz by giving her a piece of bread, that's being saved in the Jewish sense today. It's not forever. That piece of bread did not mean that she was going to survive even that day, no less the week, the month, the war, the entire experience. Salvation is an opportunity in the Jewish tradition to take another step, to advance the journey a little bit. It becomes the model for Christian salvation, a journey from darkness to light. The Christian story is told on a vertical axis, where salvation is a more permanent condition. And the metaphor is spiritual in a New Jerusalem, and the metaphor in Judaism is physical in a Jerusalem on this world. Musa is the second most mentioned person in the Quran. The whole story of Moses, the lawgiver and the leader, is central to the Muslim story also. The lamb, the Paschal lamb, is central to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It is by the blood of the lamb that in both the Jewish sense and the Christian sense and the Muslim sense that people are marked for salvation. And it recognizes that we make a fierce bargain with life. Those who are not vegetarians, those who are not vegans, and there's still one or two Unitarians who are omnivores. I don't know about Bill. We make a bargain with life, and the sacrifice of a lamb is part of the story of the three great monotheistic religions. It marks the slaughter of a lamb in place of Isaac, and the slaughter of a lamb in place of Ishmael in the Muslim version. The doorposts of the houses of the Hebrews were marked with the blood of the lamb so that the angel of death would pass over, hence Passover. It's the same metaphor. It becomes the same metaphor in Christianity, where people are sanctified and saved by the blood of the lamb. It reminds us of this relationship that we have with nature, which is, as the philosopher said at times, bloody tooth and claw. And we make a bargain, an accommodation, hopefully a responsible one with it. All of the stories, the Jewish, the Christian, the Muslim stories of the Exodus, are in lots of ways linked. And the stories are not just simply there for nothing. And we all know that the stories are linked, even if we don't know that the stories are linked. Okay, that's a little zen, let me explain. always get a little scared asking questions in the middle of sermons, but let's try it and see how this works. The Hebrews get into Egypt because one of 12 brothers betrays his brother. His brother was cast aside, thrown into a pit. He is sold for silver, rises out of the pit at the side of the king, and saves his people. Does that sound familiar to anyone? It's the story of Joseph, and it's the story of Jesus. 12 apostles, 12 brothers. One sells him into slavery. The brother who sells Joseph's name is, anyone want to take a stab? Judah. Condemns Judas in the sequel to be the person who does the selling. And the stories parallel each other, even in terms of issues of birth. Who is born with help from God? Well, all of us, and an obstetrician, and maybe a fertility specialist, okay, and an usher not paying attention at the drive-in. Okay, never mind that part. Isaac. Abraham, Abram is 98 years old. Sarai is past the age of women, which is an interesting term, but it really means postmenopausal without hormone replacement therapy. And God comes to Abraham and says, you're going to be a daddy. And he laughs. And Sarah laughs. And we're clearly meant to understand that something miraculous is going on. It's the same story retold again in the gospel narrative. Because what God does in Hebrew scriptures and Christian gospel in the Quran is God is a God of fertility and food. When you are looking at any religions and looking at comparative religions, if you're thinking fertility and food, you're not going to be far off from what the main issues are. God opens wombs and closes wombs, blesses fields, causes all kinds of terrible other things to happen, famines and plagues, but basically it becomes about, are we going to have enough to eat? Are we going to have enough children to take care of us in our old age, if we're lucky enough to live to our old age? The retirement planning in ancient days was not what it is today. These are the themes that go on throughout Scripture. The miracle stories of the Passover are not haphazard. The miracle stories of doing, God's going to trouble the water. In a pre-biblical, pre-Christian, pre-Jewish, pre-biblical Sumerian myth, God wrestles with the water for 5 days of creation. Because the water is active. It's contentious. It's dangerous. The Hebrews were a desert people. They were not sailors. The waters were scary. Jews did not become sailors until they got to Long Island and later on to Marina del Rey. The ocean was an ambivalent symbol. It was immense power, and it was a symbol of chaos and death, and yet also a source of water and a source of food, of fish. So there is this ambivalent is the root of ambivalent, this ambivalent relationship about water. And one of the things that God does in ancient Middle Eastern mythology is messes with water. God troubles the water. God parts the sea. God calms the sea. Jesus walks on the water. Jesus calms the water. They're the same motifs, and they're not accidental. They are coherent. The stories within Scripture are coherent with many, not single, but many messages and layers of meaning. People make a mistake, in my view, when they look at Scripture as it's either factual or it's just silly and throw it out. Those are the two ways of being a fundamentalist. You have another way, which is to engage the Scripture, engage the traditions. and wrestle with their many meanings and the many layers that they have. Is it accidental that you have these water images, Moses striking a rock, not Iraq, a rock, in the Sinai, and the water coming out? And then Jesus playing the marketing one-upsmanship game of saying, all right, with Moses you got water, I'm going to make it wine. There's a reason for this. Jesus says, look, you eat and you're still hungry, I'm going to give you spiritual bread. And spiritual bread recognizes that we are more and we need more than what they call in the military three hots and a cot. We need to have something for our souls, something that is deeper, something that nourishes our better angels, our best selves, and that truly fills the voids that we from time to time feel in our lives. I can almost promise you that the giant flat screen TV, nice as it is, doesn't fill a spiritual void. Music might. Maybe the sound system to that TV might do something for you if you close your eyes and let it wash over you. But just the acquisition won't do it. And part of the wisdom, again, of Scripture is that it talks about values and it talks about what we care about and should care about in a variety of ways. Since we ran a little long, I'm going to actually cut to the chase. Without getting into the long comparative religion part, we can do that in the talk back. But the chase is, when you look at the story of the Exodus and you see that it's a story, and at every Seder it's talked about how it's the birthday of freedom and how it's the story of the Jewish people. We were slaves, now we're free. And when we do the old joke about all of the Jewish holidays are, they tried to kill us, we escaped, let's eat. There's some truth to that. That's the story on one level. But now take it to the next level. Take it to the level of it being the story of every person and every life. We are, most of us, conceived in darkness. We are born through, get ready for it, folks, a wet canal. They understood, those people back then, when they were dealing with images and metaphor and simile. The parting of the Red Sea, when you look for the naturalistic explanations, it was a hurricane, it was reeds, they walked on the rocks. That's not what it was about. They understood the metaphor. The metaphor was a birth canal. The word for Egypt in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, means literally a squeezed place. A tight place. Out of darkness they are born into the light. And what do? Just what every infant does. They cry. They whine. They miss where they were. They are fed. They're not earning their own food. They are fed manna from heaven. How great is that? Except the word manna in Hebrew means, what is it? That's what it means. It doesn't mean breadfruit. It doesn't mean any of these other naturalistic explanations. It is the Hebrew manhu, what is it? They looked at it in the story and said, this you call a meal. You're the great God that got us out of Egypt. You parted the sea, and this you call dinner. My Aunt Sadie could have done so much better. But when you think about them as infants being fed and still crying, you understand the metaphor. Darkness, birth, being taken care of, and not appreciating it, and crying. And then what happens? Daddy goes away. And they build idols of gold. They rebel. What do teenagers do at the next step? They rebel. They chase after false gods. They look in silly and materialistic places. Sometimes that adolescence lasts until we're 70 or 80. But we understand that teenagers rebel. And then daddy comes back and gives them the law. Well, that's pretty much how we live. That's pretty much the story of everyone. Then they get together and they find partners and they get married and they start internalizing the laws. Then they start forming committees and they start doing all the other stuff that human beings do. And then they come to another river. They've gone from the Red Sea to the Jordan. And Moses can't cross over that river. And Moses isn't happy about not crossing over the river. In a midrash, in a story, it says that God says to Moses, you know, you've been to the mountaintop, you've seen the promised land, but you can't go. And Moses says, what do you mean I can't go? You know who I am? Very Southern California thing to say. Do you know who I am? I'm Moses. I'm the lawgiver. God says, no, no, I'm the lawgiver. You're Moses. Moses says, I'm not going, I refuse to die. And I'm going to stand right here and refuse to die. And the next thing that happens is that Moses goes up to the meeting tent where all the young people are, and they're talking and they're playing young people music, and Moses doesn't understand a word. Now, you can either look at this as the first, we'll just call it, you all know the term MCI? I'm not talking about the phone company. Minimal cognitive impairment. That's, where are my keys? So Moses is standing outside the meeting tent, and he's listening to the younger generation talking and singing, and he doesn't understand a word, and he says to God, God, you're right, time to go. And that's the story. That's the story. We're born. We cry. We learn. We rebel. We then learn how to be grown-ups, kind of, sometimes, eventually. We find mates. We have our own wonderful, perfect, for a while, children. Then we finally get wonderful, perfect grandchildren who stay wonderful and perfect if we're lucky. And we come to a river, and we can't go across that river, but our children can. And we understand that in the greater meaning of the Passover story, it is about this lap that each human being runs in the great relay race of life, that we have taken from our parents and grandparents and ancestors something, and we carry it and build on it and work on it during our time under the sun, and we pass it on to another generation who can go where we can't go, and that is into the future. Now, we have choices as we do this. One of them is, do we get stuck at that place where we are building idols of gold, where that is what is precious, as opposed to how we should be with each other? It's about an examination of our values. It's about what it is that we want to carry on our journey, what is it that we want to build on our journey, and what legacy do we want to pass on to the next generation as we complete our journey. It's the story not simply of Hebrews, it's the story of everyone. It's the story of every people who has been enslaved, every group that is still enslaved by poverty, by ignorance, by violence, by religion, by government. It is the story of every person who yearns for freedom. It's the story of every person living in freedom, not to be trapped by the flesh pots of Egypt, not to be obsessed by the gold, but to think about what are the values that I want to show through my actions. Because we all know this as adults. Children learn what we live and what they live. And they see by our examples what our values are. Not what we say they are, not what we confess that they are in any church, in any temple, in any mosque. They are what we do. And the action of the Passover is they got up, they left, they struggled, and no one lived, a couple exceptions, to live in the promised land. And so in the middle of the desert, they must have wondered, is it worthwhile? And the answer is yes, because you do and you act and you sacrifice and you care for the future. not simply for ourselves, but for our children, our grandchildren, our precious legacy. Our precious legacy that will be built or not built by what we do and choose today. Every day, every person is on the exodus of every faith. Every day we are put in a place of choosing. Choosing actions that reflect our values or actions that reflect our impulses. Actions that build for a future or actions that will take away from that future. And our power is enormous to choose and to do. And each year at the Passover, we look at a story that is told, a ritual that is told with food, but ritual is simply a reminder to take seriously the choices we have in life, to take seriously and with gratitude the time that we spend, this precious time under the sun, in this lap that we have, where we have taken the past and we create the future. It's an enormous responsibility. And the more that we are conscious of our power and our responsibility, the better we make tomorrow on the other side of that river, not for us, but for the future.